What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
At approximately 11:45 p.m. on January 27, 2002, a woman arrived at the AMF Broadway Lanes in Littleton, Colorado, to pick up her roommate, Erin Galla. As she walked into the bowling alley, she found a horrific scene. Erin, Jim Springer, and Bobby Zajac were dead. All three had been murdered. More than 24 years later, despite hundreds of tips, new technology, and evidence left behind at the scene, no one has ever been arrested for the murders of Erin, Jim, and Bobby, leaving everyone asking the same question. Who's responsible for the AMF Broadway Lanes triple homicide? Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Real quick, I just want to thank everyone for the feedback on last week's episode regarding the Gardner Museum. Glad to see that I'm not the only one who's fascinated by those types of cases, and we will do them again in the future. We have a lot of missing persons and murder cases to focus on, but every once in a while, I will sprinkle in one of those, not only for me, but also for your mental health as well. As some of you have pointed out, it's tough to come back week after week and discuss tragedy. And we know where what we do here on this channel, it's going to end with a question, right? We don't have the answers yet. So that can be demoralizing as well. So I think for the longevity of this channel and what we're building, it's good to mix in a case here and there where I wouldn't say it's a victimless crime, but at least we haven't lost someone. And that's good for our mental health moving forward. And I have to keep that in consideration as we continue to grow this channel for the long term, because I'm not going anywhere. Okay, now to focus on this case. This is another tough one. You know, we had a little bit of an easier one last week. Now we're getting back into it because essentially this murder, or I should say this triple homicide, happened in about 15 minutes. That's it. 1 second, you're making a phone call home to your family. The next minute, you're no longer with us. That quick. And it reminds us all that you just never know. I've been in some really difficult situations. I've talked about it before, police-involved shootings. And one thing I learned is life is like a light switch. 1 second it's on, the next second it can be turned off. And it allowed me to appreciate what I have in a different way, a different perspective than I usually had. And this was at 23 years old. So I always approach life from that perspective. Now, it's part of the reason I applied for the show Big Brother was because I thought about it. I kept pushing it off. It was a bucket list thing. But going through what I went through, I knew that tomorrow wasn't promised. And these types of cases remind me of that every week. And so we're going to do what we always do. We're going to cover this case. We're going to try to get some renewed attention on it. And hopefully there's someone out there who has a piece of information that hasn't been disclosed yet and at minimum can move this case forward, because candidly, right now, it appears to be at a standstill. So for anybody who doesn't know about this investigation, we're going to talk about it in detail, catch you guys up, and then talk about where we go from here. We have a lot to cover, so let's dive into this week's case. On the evening of Sunday, January 27th, 2002, AMF Broadway Lanes in Littleton, Colorado, was packed with people participating in a bowling league. Located at 5485 South Broadway, AMF Broadway had 32 lanes, making it one of the larger bowling centers in the Denver area. Several employees were working that night, including 29-year-old assistant manager James Springer Jr., who went by Jim, and 26-year-old snack bar attendant Aaron Gala. Neither of them had been working at AMF Broadway for very long. Jim had started his job on December 1st after moving to the Littleton area from Utah specifically for the position. He hoped the move would allow him to build a better life for him and his family. Shortly after Jim moved, his wife Jennifer and their two young sons joined him. JD was 19 months old and Devin was just 4 months old. Everyone who knew Jim said he loved his children more than anything in the world. Erin had been working at AMF Broadway for a few months and was known for being a sweet person. She lived with a roommate and was a devoted single mother raising her two daughters, 6-year-old Casey and 3-year-old Courtney. Also working at AMF Broadway that night was 23-year-old Robert Zajac, who went by Bobby, and he was bowling in the Sunday League as a substitute for another player. Bobby actually worked as a mechanic at another AMF Broadway alley in Highlands Ranch, but he was well known at the Broadway location as well. Bowling was a huge part of Bobby's life. His family said his whole life revolved around the sport since he was a young child. He was so talented that he had bowled multiple perfect games and was likely to eventually go pro. Outside of bowling, Bobby was known for having a good sense of humor. He was fun-loving and close to his parents, Roy and Bonnie, who he lived with. When AMF Broadway closed at 11 p.m. on the night of January 27th, Bobby stayed behind because Jim had offered to give him a ride home. Before they could leave, Jim and Aaron still needed to tally up the night's receipts and finish up with some other business. Then, at approximately 11:30 p.m., Jim called his wife and told her that he was about to leave. He explained that he would be giving Bobby a ride home, and they were just waiting for Aaron's roommate to pick her up. You see, Aaron's car had broken down that day, so her roommate had driven her to work and was coming back to get her. But Jim, Aaron, and Bobby would never make it home. At 11:51 p.m., Aaron's roommate called 911 from the bowling alley. She told the dispatcher she had arrived to pick up Aaron and instead found two people murdered inside the office. Officers responded and quickly discovered a third person dead in that same office. The victims were Aaron Gala, Jim Springer, and Bobby Zajac. All three had been shot with a handgun, but the weapon was not found at the scene. Investigators have never revealed how many times each victim was shot or where they were shot. They also have not publicly disclosed what type of handgun was used or whether there were any signs of a struggle. They have only said it appears that the victims died where they were shot. And I believe they were executed. Why that is, it's the location of where they were all found and also another piece of eyewitness testimony from Aaron's roommate, which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. And when I do, I think it'll make sense to you and you guys can weigh in the comments and let me know if you agree or not. Now, investigators have also said the office safe was open and the money was missing, though they never released the amount. But given that the bowling alley had just finished the weekend, which was its busiest time, there could have been a significant amount of money inside. And I do want to talk more about Aaron's roommate, but before I do, I want to mention that her name has never been publicly released. And could I figure it out? Have I already figured it out? Maybe. But out of respect for her, I'm not going to mention it here. So let's talk about her, because officers spoke with her and they learned that she arrived at approximately 11:45 p.m. to pick up Aaron. She parked near the door on the south side of the building close to the office. As she sat in the car, she said she heard three loud bangs coming from inside the bowling alley. A few minutes later, she saw a man walk out of the building. And as he did, he looked at her, he smirked at her, and then he got into a dark colored newer model full-size pickup truck and drove off heading south. And this is the information I was talking about a few moments ago. The fact that all three victims were found in the office, the fact that the roommate heard only three bangs, and the fact that it appeared to be simultaneous. What I think happened is that the perpetrator here gathered them into the office and shot them all at the same time, execution style. That's my belief. I have nothing to substantiate it, but based on the totality of the circumstances, using a little bit of critical thinking, that's what we're looking at here. And it kind of reminds me of the Lane Bryant case, if you remember that one. Now, Aaron's roommate described this suspect as a white man between 25 and 35 years old, approximately 6 feet tall with a muscular build, shaved head, and no facial hair. He was wearing a dark colored trench coat that extended below his knees. After waiting a few more minutes, she decided to go into the bowling alley and she began calling out for Erin. And when she didn't answer, she walked into the office and that's when she found her. And another body was lying nearby, but as I mentioned earlier, she did not see the third victim before calling 911. And again, this just reaffirms what I've just said. I believe that they were doing their whatever they had to do for the end of the night, and maybe they were already in the office together, but when the person comes in there, or maybe they were already inside, they go right into the office, they grab what they need to grab, probably have them open the safe, or it was already open, and before leaving, the suspect shoots all three of them. And the only reason I believe that they may have been gathered into the office is when Erin's roommate walked inside, if he had gathered them in there, he would have lined them up and shot them all and she would have seen them. But the fact that one was maybe off to the left or off to the right, it may have been a situation where gathered them in there, and as soon as the last person walked in, he shot all three of them. And so investigators processed the bowling alley, collecting multiple items as evidence, including trash from the men's restroom. They also looked for any surveillance footage that could show what happened that night, but AMF Broadway, like most bowling alleys at the time, did not have any type of security or surveillance system. A nearby business, R&B Liquor, did have a camera that captured the parking lot just south of the bowling alley, so investigators reviewed that footage, but if they found anything significant, they have never shared it publicly. Investigators also started looking into other recent burglaries in the area, and as they did, they learned that AMF Broadway itself had been burglarized exactly 1 week earlier. During the early morning hours of Monday, January 21st, just hours after the bowling alley closed, someone broke a window and burglarized the business. The thief tried to break into the safe, but was unsuccessful in getting it open. Instead of stealing cash, the thief had to pivot and started gathering phones and other equipment, but then a cleaning crew showed up, so the burglar had to flee. The thief was never caught, and the damaged safe was never replaced, so when the bowling alley was robbed just 1 week later on January 27th, the same damaged safe was still inside. At that point, investigators did not know whether the January 21st burglary was connected to the January 27th murders. They told the media they were considering robbery, burglary, and revenge as possible motives, but it was still too early to determine whether something else was going on. And before we go any further, I just want to put a bookmark here because we're going to come back to this and it's going to make more sense during the perspective. But I want to discuss the January 21st burglary in a vacuum by itself. To me, in my experience as not only a local patrolman, but as a detective, the description of this burglary sounds like someone who has a substance abuse issue. We saw this a lot on the streets where they would steal whatever they could that potentially had value. Yes, the number one priority was any cash, any change inside the cup holders or the glove box. But when that failed, you look for phones, GPS units, radios. You take whatever you could because you could trade that for drugs. And that's what it sounds like here, right? Bowling alleys aren't known to have a lot of cash, but it's minimal security. You can get in, you can get out, you can grab whatever's not bolted to the ground. And it sounds to me like the thief went in looking for cash, tried the safe, couldn't get in, so they proceeded to take anything of value that they could trade in later for drugs. That's my opinion. Why that's important, we'll come back to later. It could be connected, it may not be, but that if I had to develop a profile on the suspect, I don't think this is some high-level criminal. This is probably a local person who has some substance abuse issues and was looking for a quick cash grab. Could this still be related to the robbery slash murder? Absolutely. But in my experience, normally these types of suspects, they're looking for unoccupied vehicles where they can go in and get out without anybody seeing them. They're not looking for an altercation. They want something easy. Whoever committed this robbery, they knew people would be inside. And it appears as if not only did they rob the place, but they also intended from the get-go on killing anybody left behind because they didn't want any witnesses. To me, these two crimes seem to be compartmentalized. They seem to be different. And if you made me choose, I would say they're unrelated, but I have nothing to base that off of. It could be a continuation of what happened the week before. That is just as possible, but I would say 51% not connected. But if I found out tomorrow that it was, I wouldn't be surprised. What do you guys think? Let me know in the comment section below. Do you feel that these two crimes are connected or it's just a coincidence? And so at that point, investigators interviewed other bowling alley employees along with the victim's family members and associates, hoping someone could provide information that would point them in the right direction, but everywhere they looked seemed to lead to another dead end. More than a dozen law enforcement officers continued working the case, but a week passed without any major developments. Then investigators released a composite sketch of the man Aaron's roommate had seen leaving the bowling alley that night. Investigators said, quote, "This person may or may not be a suspect in the crime. It's obviously someone we want to talk to." And I'm going to throw the sketch up here. This is one of the worst sketches I've ever seen. It could be absolutely anyone. I don't like to talk down this stuff because I want to be optimistic. But I looked at the photo and there's no distinguishing marks in it. I know it's a photocopy of the drawing, but overall, it's not very helpful. And as far as whether this person's connected to the crime or not, I know they're just trying to cover their bases, but this person's connected. Aaron's roommate heard the three loud bangs, and then this man walked out after that. So he was present for the robbery, no doubt about it. Did he pull the trigger? Was there someone else there? I can't tell you that part of it, but this man was absolutely present and knew exactly what happened inside that establishment. So yes, he is connected to the crime. He is a suspect. The same time that law enforcement made this announcement and put out the sketch, AMF Bowling also announced it was offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of whoever was responsible for the killings. One day after releasing the sketch and announcing the reward, investigators spent the day putting up hundreds of flyers around town. But the effort did not lead them to the man Aaron's roommate had seen leaving the bowling alley. So, investigators released a second composite sketch, but this one showed a completely different man who apparently had been seen talking to at least one of the AMF Broadway Lanes employees on the night of the murders. And we're going to get into this guy because he may or may not be connected, but it's worth talking about. And we're going to do it right after the break. You've heard me talk about Hungry Root before, so you know how much I love it. It has truly simplified my life. I'm someone who works a lot of hours. I'm traveling a lot right now. And then I got the two little ones at home. So between horseback riding, softball practice, basketball camp, you name it, I'm busy. So it's been a game changer when it comes to trying to reach my health goals by having Hungry Root do all of my weekly food shopping for me. Hungry Root plans all of my meals and groceries for the week, fills my cart, and delivers everything I'll need to eat healthy every day, all while fitting my health goals, dietary preferences, and budget. I tried something new this week. I'm not a huge pasta person, but I do love rigatoni. So I tried their rigatoni and lamb bolognese. Amazing, very delicious, and not too heavy on the sauce. So that was something that was important to me. Then I did right before my workout, I wanted to get some protein in. So I did their turkey and cheese roll-ups. Tasted amazing. Didn't taste like something that came out of a grocery store and some prepackaged thing. Delicious. And then, as you guys know, I have a sweet tooth and I got to have a little dessert before I go to bed. I try to keep it 2 hours before I go to bed. So this week I had the chocolate banana bites. If you like chocolate, if you like banana, you know what I'm talking about. Top notch. Love it. Love Hungry Root. Loves that it gets me trying new things. And unlike other food delivery companies, Hungry Root now has over 50,000 chef-crafted recipes to choose from each week, with many ready in just 15 minutes or less, which is huge. And with over 1,000 grocery items like smoothies, sweets, kid snacks, salad kits, ready-to-eat meals, and supplements, it's insanely easy to find something that fits everyone's taste and nutritional goals. And Hungry Root holds all of its foods to high standards, screening out over 200 additives, including high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and preservatives. They source only high-quality meat and seafood with no hormones or antibiotics, offer organic produce and non-GMO options, and carry trusted healthy brands like Oatly, Vital Farms, Ithaca Hummus, Harmless Harvest, and many more. I know I talk about Hungry Root all the time, but I truly do think you're going to love it as much as I do. All you got to do is try it. And for a limited time, you can get 40% off your first box, plus get a free item in every box for life. All you have to do is go to hungryroot.com/detective and use my code detective. That's hungryroot.com/detective, code detective, to get 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life. Give it a try. You will not regret it. All right, we're back. So let's talk about this man in the second sketch, because very little information about him has ever been released. What we do know is that he was seen inside the bowling alley sometime between 10 and 11 p.m. on the same night of the murders. This person was described as a white man with a dark or olive complexion, black bushy hair, a mustache, and black rimmed glasses. He was believed to be between 45 and 55 years old, approximately 5 foot 10 inches tall, maybe even 6 foot tall, and had a medium build. Investigators labeled this man as a potential witness. Now, this fits, right? If this guy was one of the last people in there, maybe there was some suspicious behavior by him. Maybe he was someone who wasn't known to the other patrons, to the other employees. And when we think about this case as a whole, you do have to wonder, even though Aaron's roommate saw one man coming outside, was there a second party? Was there a co-conspirator? Was there somebody who was inside the bowling establishment, gathering intelligence, learning who was in there, learning the practices, the policy, how people were moving, and relaying that information back to the shooter who was outside in their truck? Very possible, right? Especially if it appeared this person wasn't bowling, was kind of just sitting around spectating and didn't really know anyone. So I don't know the details of this. And just to kind of fast forward to current times, we still don't know a lot about this guy. But there's something about him where after interviewing everybody who was there that night, it appears to me that they were able to cross everyone off the list as far as who they were, where they were from, what they were doing there. And this is one of the few people that still have a question mark over their head. And as we sit here today, we still don't know who this guy is. He's never come forward. And so that is concerning when you think about the fact that everyone from the area knew that this happened and probably was keeping up on the news. So when this person's sketch was released, which I have up on the screen right now, you would think they would come forward. And yet, as far as we know, they never did. Now, that being said, there is also a possibility that they have spoke with police and law enforcement, being tight-lipped, hasn't disclosed that information. But if that's the case, I strongly disagree with that approach. They should clear this person and let everyone know that they're no longer a person of interest and they're no longer looking to speak with them. For the next 6 months, two senior detectives were assigned to the case full-time. They followed up on approximately 300 tips and collected more than 200 pieces of evidence, but they still weren't getting any closer to identifying who killed Aaron, Bobby, and Jim. So investigators decided to release a little more information about two jackets that had been found at the crime scene. Both were sitting on top of the copy machine inside the office where all three victims were located, and investigators did not know who these jackets belonged to. The first was a size medium navy blue insulated jacket with a reflective white stripe running horizontally across the front and back. The word Abercrombie was stitched over the left front side. Inside one of the pockets, investigators found a $6 general admission ticket for the National Western Stock Show and Rodeo. The ticket was wrinkled and the ink had faded, but it listed dates of January 14th to January 18th and January 22nd to January 25th of 2002. The second jacket was a size 2X leather jacket with a vintage varsity label. It had a dark brown body with tan suede sleeves, dark leather elbow patches, and a brown and tan stripe elastic collar, wristbands, and waistband. Inside the right front pocket, investigators found a 4-inch harmonica in a leather case and a small tube of Neosporin. But none of those items helped investigators determine who the jackets belonged to. The manager, who had been working that day, said that they had not seen either of those jackets in the office before they left, and the victims' families also confirmed that the jackets did not belong to Aaron, Bobby, or Jim. Investigators released photographs of both jackets to the media, hoping the owners would recognize them and come forward. At the same time, they also released more information about what they had come to believe about the person responsible for the murders. Investigators believe the person was familiar with the bowling alley and the bowling community, either personally or through someone they knew. They believe the person knew the bowling center's closing times and procedures, and may have even known one or more of the victims. They also believe the person probably had a criminal history and may have been responsible for the attempted burglary at the AMF Broadway 1 week earlier. Investigators believe the robbery on January 27th had been planned and that the person responsible might still be somewhere in the state. And they base these beliefs on the location and the type of business that was targeted, right? You guys know by now that bowling alleys aren't typically targeted for robberies, right? More than likely, there's not going to be a lot of money inside. So the risk isn't worth the reward. On top of that, AMF Broadway lanes could not be seen from either of the two streets that ran near it. So this isn't something where a transient would be passing through and say, oh, you know what? This is a quick smash and grab. I can get in, I can get out, and I can keep on moving. You, for one, would have to know about this particular bowling alley and where it's located, and then still decide, even though there's not going to be a lot of money inside, that this is the spot you want to hit. So as they're suggesting here, more than likely, this is someone who had a familiarity with not only bowling alleys in general, but this specific one, and knew that they could go in there at a particular time where there wouldn't be a lot of people and where the office would have a safe, and this would be at the end of the weekend where it would be the most money. They could go in, grab the cash, and get out in a matter of minutes. And essentially, that's exactly what they did. Unfortunately, they also murdered three people. And I do want to go back for a second because I talked about a lot, right? Let's start with the jackets. I'm going to give more of my opinions on the jackets and the perspective, but could these jackets be connected? Absolutely. I tend to lean the other way. Although I will say, again, as we sit here right now, there has been never any public information to suggest that these jackets have been claimed, that someone has come forward and said, hey, those are mine. And again, just like this man with the mustache, you would think everyone would be watching the news. And once they put out these pictures, which again, I'll have the pictures of the jackets up here. This is a photocopy of the article. You would think someone would go, oh my God, yeah, I was bowling there last night. I forgot my jacket, my harmonica. I'm going to go collect it. Or, oh my God, they're looking at this jacket as potentially connected to these shootings. I'm going to go let them know that I'm a regular. I bowl there all the time. Or I went there with some friends and they can corroborate your story. From what we know, that's never happened, which does make it concerning. It makes it suspicious, right? There's a big question mark over it. But I also go back to the fact that in this particular case, investigators have been very tight-lipped and they've only released information when absolutely necessary. So is it possible that someone came forward and they're just not putting that out there as part of a strategy so that the suspects don't know what they're onto or what they're still considering? Potentially. But if that is the case, again, at this point in time, we're talking 24 years later, I disagree with that approach. If these jackets are not connected, we should know that information. But I'll talk more about these jackets, what it means and what we can do with them, and whether or not I believe they're connected. By January 2003, 1 year had passed since Aaron, Bobby, and Jim were killed. Investigators said they were still constantly working the case and were determined to figure out who was responsible. Over the first year, they had followed up on approximately 400 tips and sent hundreds of pieces of evidence to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation for testing. They also collected DNA samples from dozens of people, but they still did not have any suspects. But even with the lack of leads, investigators said that they did have a theory about what happened that night, but they didn't share any further details, only saying the strongest tips they received continued pointing them in the same direction and seemed to match the profile they had developed of the person responsible. So a little cryptic, and I wish I could say that I'm going to talk about an update later where we get more information about this alleged person. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Like I said, they've been very tight-lipped. But there were still some things they weren't sure about in this whole case, including whether the murders were connected to the burglary at AMF Broadway 1 week earlier. And even one detective came out and said, quote, I tend to think they're related. That's one of the angles we're looking at. To me, this just says we're still considering every possibility. I don't think there's any way they can confirm that these two incidents are related until they find the person. You think about the MO here, it's completely different. One waited until the business was closed, early morning hours, went in through a window, proceeded to take phones and other equipment. The suspect in the robbery slash murder went in through the entrance, gathered everyone in the office, grabbed the money, proceeded to kill everyone inside, leaving no witnesses behind, and then walked right out the door and smirked at a witness that was staring right at him. To me, completely separate profiles. And if, like I said multiple times, if you made me choose, I do not think they're related. Then in early 2007, investigators revealed new information about the case. They said that just a few months after the murders, a grand jury investigation into a methamphetamine ring uncovered connections to Aaron. And we're going to talk about that and my perspective after the break. If you've tried everything to lose weight and you still feel stuck, this summer can be different. Weight Loss by Hers is designed to support you in reaching your goals with access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, you can lose up to 20% of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep the weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first ever GLP-1 for weight loss, so there's no needles necessary. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there, because weight loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and much more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget if you're eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/detective to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/detective. One more time, forhers.com/detective. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is a registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com. All right, so we're back from break, and we have to talk about this new information, because as I mentioned earlier with the burglary, to me, it would be drug-related. That's the type of person we're looking for, and then you have this information. So let's discuss exactly what was said. So investigators told the Denver Post, quote, "There is a connection, but we are not able to talk to her, so we can't fully explore what her involvement was. There is some indication that she was involved with meth to some degree. We can confirm that. We don't know if she was a recreational user or something more." However, investigators made it very clear that they did not know whether that connection had anything to do with the triple homicide. They said the meth angle was just one of several theories they had considered while investigating this case. And listen, this is an angle you have to explore even without this information. I talked about it at the beginning of the episode. When you think about the MO of the burglary, my head automatically goes toward drugs. Even with the robbery slash murder, I'm still there. Just because it's a murder doesn't mean it's not connected to someone who is in need of cash and was desperately trying to get it as fast as possible. And the fact that they walked out of the bowling alley, saw a witness and didn't kill them, leaving someone behind who could identify them, shows me that this isn't some professional. This is someone who wanted to get in and get out as fast as possible. And I don't know why they shot the people inside. We may never know. But now you add this other layer onto it where potentially one of the victims had a connection to meth. It could just be a coincidence, or there could be something more. Did Aaron know this person and that's why they killed them? Or did Aaron disclose some information about the practices and policies of the bowling alley, and whether it was a friend or a friend of the friend, they learned about it and they decided to act on it and grab the money because they knew that the business was susceptible during those hours, especially at the end of the weekend when there would be a lot of money. Again, this would be someone who would have a familiarity with the bowling alley. It doesn't mean they were there every weekend. It just means they knew more information than the normal person would know about the establishment. And by the way, I know other people have covered this, but there are certain articles that I've referenced that we haven't seen anywhere else. And that's why it's important to continue covering these cases. Someone may be sitting at home thinking they know everything about it, and then I pull up this 2007 article and something clicks for them. At least that's what I'm hoping. But unfortunately, after this 2007 article, another 14 years passed before there was another major update in the case. In February of 2001, the Littleton Police Department held a press conference and announced that the investigation was being reinvigorated. Using new technology, investigators were going back through every piece of evidence they collected in the case. They were reviewing and retesting evidence, including items collected from the trash in the men's restroom and other items found on the property. They were also using genetic genealogy. This is all great. This is all great in recommendations that would have at the end of the episode, but they're already doing it. Kudos to the Littleton Police Department. They also went on to say that this technology and these practices, quote, were allowing them to develop new investigative leads, though no further details about those leads were shared. At the same time, investigators began conducting new interviews. They said, quote, We know there is likely information that has not been shared. We believe people with information surrounding the case remain in our community. So they're saying it without actually saying it directly, that they believe these crimes were committed by locals. Investigators also revealed one significant change in their theory about the case. They now believe that the burglary at AMF Broadway 1 week prior to the murders was indeed connected to what happened on January 27th. And as I've already said, I'm 51/49% in favor of this not being connected, but I'm not oblivious to the fact that I have a fraction of the information and evidence connected to this case. So I will always defer to the investigators actually responsible for the crime and the people who have access to everything I don't. I would love for them to share that information with me, and maybe I would agree or maybe I would disagree. However, I wish they would disclose what they have that ties these two cases together, just to prove that it's not just some new investigator who looked at it and is subjectively saying, yeah, I believe they're connected, when in reality, there's no direct evidence. Does it matter? Not really. At the end of the day, you still have to find the person responsible for both crimes. And at that point, you can decide whether they're connected or not. But at minimum, you get some new data that you can go off of. So at this point, connected or not, we just got to find the people. Until then, we got nothing. In my opinion, we need to have at least one of the crimes solved, and then you can reverse engineer it. But if I was a betting man, I would say they are not connected. I actually think the person who committed the crime the week prior is less likely to go back, because now they know that people are onto them. There's going to be a heightened sensitivity. They may have installed camera equipment. And now if I'm going to do it again, I'm choosing a different establishment. But nobody said these criminals were smart. So could it be a retaliatory thing where they were aggravated that they didn't get what they wanted the first time and they decided to go in and do it differently and actually make sure they got what they went there for by bringing a gun and waiting till people were there? Yes, there's a possibility that there was an escalation. But from where I'm sitting, historically speaking, that's not how it goes. But if someone from the Littleton Police Department wants to come on here or put out another public statement about the case explaining why they feel that way, I would love to hear it. And I am more than willing to change my opinion if new information is released. A few months later, in June of 2021, the FBI announced on social media that they were assisting the Littleton Police Department with a search near Interstate 270 and the Platte River. They confirmed the search was, quote, directly related to the bowling alley murders. However, because the investigation was still, quote, active and ongoing, the FBI would not reveal what they were searching for or what information had led them to that area. So it was unclear exactly what investigators were hoping to find. The FBI went on to thank the community for continuing to provide tips and information. They said those tips had, quote, made a difference. The last major update in the case came in early 2026. By that point, 24 years had passed since Aaron, Jim, and Bobby were killed. The FBI released a statement confirming they were still assisting the Littleton Police Department with the investigation, but that was it. And unfortunately, that's where things stand today. There have been no arrests, and Aaron, Jim, and Bobby's families are still waiting for answers. January 27, 2027 will mark 25 years since Aaron Gala, Jim Springer, and Bobby Zajac were taken from this world. A quarter of a century without answers about who killed them or why. That's far too long, so let's not let this case reach that grim anniversary without answers. All right, so let's dive into this perspective. And this is one of those cases where it really is a be on the lookout. It seems like the Littleton Police Department and the FBI is truly doing the best they can. And I commend them for that. You know, sometimes even when the best efforts are put forward and all the resources involving technology and science are implemented, sometimes you just can't get that break that you need. And it seems like that's what's happening here. But just to go over a couple things as we kind of break this one down. The jackets. In my opinion, again, without having all the information, not connected. Why? First off, unless we found out that the bushy mustache guy was wearing a jacket with a similar description to one of these two jackets, I don't think it's connected. But more than that, the bald guy that we know was involved with the shooting, when he left, according to Aaron's roommate, he was wearing a trench coat. He had a jacket on. Are we to believe he had another jacket on top of that? Highly unlikely. But let's even add on to that, right? We know that this crime occurred within approximately 15 minutes, okay? Did they have time to gather everyone up, bring him in the office, and then at one point, while holding these people at gunpoint, say, oh, you know what? Let's take our jackets off. Let's potentially leave something behind. Why would you need to take the jackets off? That's not what you're thinking about in those moments. So I don't want to be a Debbie Downer here, but I don't think the jackets are connected. I think the jackets belong to someone who was at that establishment maybe that night or maybe weeks prior. And part of their policies and procedures was to go around and collect anything that was left behind and put it in lost and found, which what I would assume was located in or near the office. Now, if that's the case, again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. Why not come out and say that? Is it a strategy so that the suspects think you may be on the wrong path? Potentially, but we're talking 25 years later. I think at this point, you should be releasing that information if there's been an update. Now, if I'm wrong, and I really truly hope I am, if these jackets are connected, we have a harmonica, we have a ticket. These things can be tracked down, but the harmonicas especially, there's going to be DNA on that. So if it was collected and preserved correctly, you could use the latest DNA technology to potentially go back and identify who that harmonica belonged to, or at least who used it. And that's probably what they're trying to do, right? If nobody's come forward about these jackets yet, that should raise a little bit of an eyebrow, right? If it would belong to someone who was there, working there, or just bowling there or hanging out there, these are pretty detailed descriptions of these jackets. They put out photos. You would think those people would have come forward. So if they haven't, well, then unfortunately, you got to pull that thread, even though it may be a waste of time. And that's probably what they're doing. I would imagine that they're resubmitting that harmonica, resubmitting the Neosporin, and also tracking down this ticket again to see if they can find any information that would potentially lead them to the owners of these jackets and either bring them in for questioning and see if they're connected or rule them out. And as far as the suspects themselves, I agree with law enforcement's assessment here. These are locals. These are more than likely career criminals, but low-level criminals where they may have substance abuse issues. They were looking for a quick grab. They may have committed multiple crimes before, burglaries, thefts, larcenies, things of that nature. And they're someone who's familiar with this establishment, maybe as a patron or maybe as a former employee of a similar establishment, another bowling alley somewhere else. And they know that on the weekends, that's when the most money comes in. And right at closing, they're going to be tallying up receipts, counting cash, putting it into the safe, and there's not going to be a lot of people inside, so not a lot of witnesses. Why they chose to kill these three innocent souls, I can't rationalize the irrational. Like I mentioned earlier, same thing with the Lane Bryant murders. It doesn't make sense. It was unnecessary. If you were so concerned about your identity, wear a mask. I don't understand it, but we're never going to understand it. Why this person did what they did, it's not going to make sense to you and I. But I do believe this is someone who is looking for quick money with not a lot of blowback, no armed security, no cameras. They could take that money and purchase whatever they needed to purchase at that particular moment. And the fact that this bald man walked out of this place without covering their face and actually smirked at a witness tells me they're a moron. And that this isn't some high caliber individual who took a lot of time to plan this whole thing out. They took a gun, they went in there at closing time, they grabbed the cash, and because they're a complete scumbag, more concerned about themselves and getting caught, they shot these people just to ensure that they wouldn't be able to tell their story later. So where do we go from here? Again, I agree with law enforcement. Someone from that community knows who these people are. There have been rumblings about why they did this. And for some reason, they haven't come forward yet. Maybe they don't know that they have information that is critical to solving this case. So just to recap, on January 27th, 2002, Aaron Gala, Jim Springer Jr., and Robert Zajac were found shot to death inside the AMF Broadway Lanes in Littleton, Colorado. The bowling alley safe was open and the money was missing, and a man was seen leaving shortly after three loud bangs were heard from inside. Despite hundreds of tips and more than 24 years of investigation, no one has ever been arrested and the case remains unsolved. If you have any information, you can call the FBI Denver field office at 303-629-7171 or Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. As always, my final words go out to the friends and family of Aaron, Jim, and Bobby. I'm talking about Jennifer, JD, Devin, Casey, Courtney, Ray, and Bonnie. All of you affected by this. Lives changed forever. And now, when we think about the children, they're around 24, 25 years old, maybe a little older, growing up not knowing what happened to their parent, not knowing who's responsible. So this is still their nightmare, and they're living it every day. And if they happen to watch or listen to this, I want you guys to know you're not alone. You have an entire community supporting you, trying to get answers. And if there's anything I can do to help, you know where to find me. I'll be right here. And as I said at the end of the episode, the 25-year anniversary is right around the corner. Let's not let it get to that date without pushing this case forward. I really hope that I have an update soon and I'm able to share it with you guys. But until then, please, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluff Mobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on Spin Quest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to spinquest.com right now.
Spin Quest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit spinquest.com for more details.